The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pete does the right thing and gets punished. When will he ever learn that no good deed goes unpunished? Rand finds a solution, but the solution is there's no way out. So the people who want out, get out by not using the solution. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
Tuesday, March 5th, ELN will be at the Sheraton Grand in Los Angeles from 8 a.m. till 4 p.m. Don't miss this unique opportunity to network with other executive leaders and grow your network.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The major AT&T outage of last week was apparently caused by an improvement in their network. 911 service was also out as a result of the outage for a significant part of the country. Just imagine how much better things will be when they improve things next time. Don't depend on the internet or your cell phone, because that's what's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Something you might not be aware of is that after almost any substantial event in the news, there will be wild rumors spread over the internet about it. It really doesn't matter what the particular event is, but the more newsworthy it is, the more crap will be directed at the world at large and as well as the individuals involved. While we might expect this by now based on news feeds and similar sources, something most folks are not aware of is the extent to which individuals involved are being harassed in one way or another. Take, for example, a wildfire in the Los Angeles area. We have these fairly often, and you would expect various rumors about how they came to be to show up. You might expect to hear it was intentionally sparked by an arsonist from the Middle East. Maybe it was intended as part of a controlled burn that got out of control, or maybe it was sparked by the electrical power grid, or maybe there was a quadcopter involved, a private citizen. Who knows? Of course, these might be true, so they're credible, and once they're debunked by the officials, these memes generally settle down, although sometimes they continue on for a long period of time. But that's not the really bad part of what happens. This is the bad part. Increasingly, the individuals involved, like the firefighters who save lives, or the doctors in the hospitals treating patients, or the investigative agents looking at the matter, are directly targeted for individual harassment. For example, if the rumor is that the fires started by the firefighters in a controlled burn, the firefighters will then have their families targeted by people accusing them and claiming that they intentionally did these things. And if somebody died, they're going to be accused of intentionally murdering them or something like that. This sort of crazy, sick, disgusting treatment of individuals who are trying to save lives and help people is one of the most disgraceful applications of disinformation. The way they do these things starts with getting details on the heroes from news stories or other online sources, and then using lookups. They look up the address or information on the families, and then their sickness really goes from online stalking to swatting or something similar. Swatting is where they call the police and report a shooting in progress or some similar thing at the target's home address. So the police show up ready for a possible shooting, and it endangers everybody, and it's disruptive to the family, and typically they'll do it in the middle of the night, just destroying things about the family. It's not enough that these people suffer from having to deal with the deaths of people under their care, having to deal with the emergency situation and the horrible things that result for no good reason other than their own sickness. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. Brought to you by time and on time by KMBY, 1240 AM, in Monterey, California, and over the internet to the whole world. Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
Just because they're with a lot more, they're with a bigger, what would you say, a bigger group of different kinds of people, usually learning, still young, still naive. Because I think, let me give you an example where I'm thinking with this, because not just from my history with university, but so for example, I was talking to this person over Hacker High School, which is a project that we provide.
Yeah, we're going to get to Hacker High School in the next segment. So,
okay. Just wanted to say, he's a professor at university. I want to say it was like Texas or Arizona. I can't remember. And he had students that, again, through their own cyber program, whatever, it wasn't our Hacker High School. And he was asking me about how do we handle ethics? Do we have the kids sign something? And I said, no, because they're under 18. It makes no sense. I would rather teach them empathy than have them sign a paper.
Yeah, it's not a legally binding contract. Yeah.
and just putting them a paper that they sign, I think, teaches the wrong thing. Yeah. So he was saying that that's something they do. And he said it puts them in a tough spot because he had a student who came to him who had figured out some kind of vulnerability or something, and he could get into the over Windows. He could get into the private shares of some of the teachers, and he could get their documents, whatever it was on their computer. Yeah, and that student went to him and told him that that he noticed this and he could do it. And I said, "Oh, what did you do?" Thinking I know what I would do. I would probably congratulate him, say, great work. Thank you for coming to me. And then go to the administration and say, I discovered this vulnerability with my class or with a student, and it needs to get fixed. That's what I would have said. Instead, he said he marched the student down to the administration because they have strict ethics policies that he shouldn't even be trying those things. And he was kicked out of the program.
Well, did they say he was trying those things or did he just encounter it? But I don't want to get into the details.
I don't know. All I know is that he said the kid came to him as the professor of this to tell him that it was possible.
So I had a student when I was a professor at the University of Cincinnati who I caught with a key, a master key, which was not a legitimate master key. It was a master key that he or somebody else had created by taking multiple keys and figuring out how to make the master out of it. That could allow him into all sorts of places that he was not authorized to go. So I had him give it to me and asked him repeatedly about where it came from and so forth. But I didn't report him. I just told him, you know, wrong, unethical, inappropriate. Don't do this again. You know, I have you on a list. But didn't want to go any further. And I had the key. And like I said, I used that to test on doors that I had legitimate access to, just to verify that it was a master key and understood how it got created out of a set of other keys, right? You find the common teeth and you can look it up on the internet to find out how to make master keys. So I think that those ethical things arise, but I find the cybersecurity business, you know, those to me are relatively minor, although obviously for the individuals affected, it can be very substantial. But I've had a number of instances where people have ended up going to jail, which is much different from being kicked out of a program in a school.
Sure.
And one of the earliest cases I worked on was a student who was, potentially going to be kicked out of a university program because of, regardless of the minutiae, it turned out that he probably was not guilty. And that's one of the things that I showed. But that's a discussion for another time.
Okay. The eternal ethical discussion of, what do you do when you encounter this stuff? And I don't have a clarifying answer for this. I think situation ethics, you know, the first word in the phrase situation is everything.
Well, yeah, we talked a lot recently about how the maturity level of AI, right? And, and in the last segment, we're talking about policy frameworks and adherence and so forth and interpretation, right? There are a lot of gaps in a lot of policies. And then there's enforcement, of violations. And in your example right there with Pete, what you were saying is that you chose not to follow the rules.
I didn't say that. Right. I don't believe I was aware of any rule that required me to report any such thing.
There you go. So, but it may have been there, in the agreements you signed and so forth, there may have been some diligence, phrase of do the right thing. It could be interpreted by lawyers who wanted, who knows, right?
Yes, it could be interpreted different ways, which is the fundamental of the situation ethics, that when you have an option of how to interpret it, you have to choose the option that you think is, it's better if you choose the one you think is right, as opposed to the one that most advantages you, because generally speaking, the one that most advantages you is the one that ends you up in jail.
Well, and let's think about this as a comparative with where AI is today and where we see it getting to how soon. Now, you made what I think is the accurate decision that your enforcement of that policy was appropriate and achieved the end of the intention of the policy and quite probably, even the letter of it, though, as we both just said, stare at it hard enough with a lot of lawyers and reference other related texts, maybe, there was something, but imagine an AI doing that. If you just took laws and policies as they exist and had AI with, cameras following all of us around, we would all be, we would be so deeply in debt, with fines by the end of the day.
We would be in jail permanently.
Right. <That's it. Yeah.
laughs> Because, come on, look, you're out on the street and you spit, okay? You take off your hat when you go into a building. Oh, your hat wasn't off when you got into the building, right? You had bare feet. You went on the beach, when you weren't supposed to go on the beach. You took a pebble that you thought was a beautiful pebble, right? Whatever, right? You spat. You stayed too long at the parking meter. you drove 66 or 65.001 miles an hour on the freeway.
I have on the boat here a little manatee bone from a left flipper, that I found on an island in the Indian River in the Intracoastal, that I didn't know was a manatee bone. I was sort of cleaning up this little beach on this island when I was there, but I thought this little bone, and I looked it up. And now I don't know. I may be breaking the law right now by having that or by not reporting it or something. But
well, you've now reported it, you know, on public radio, so you know,
right?
You better get rid of it before it airs.
The advantage, you and I talk about this a lot in the Augatera and the electric boat perspective. You know, I spoke with a great park ranger in the Everglades National Park about this. Is our boats will actually just know the laws and where they can be, they can't be, and they'll know where they are. So when you try to take them where they can't go, they won't go there, just won't do it, right? And that, you know, level of adherence you can get for things like that. But, you know, most policy, most law is much more ambiguous, right? And that's
so there are people that when you
until AI can do that in any effective way like humans do.
There are people that when you draw a line, you're asking them to cross it. And there are other people that when you draw a line, they're going to stay back from it. And, you know, I think that all of those people are valuable to society. However, you know, how do we get along with each other? How does the society prosper? How do we all prosper? If you're not going to follow the rules and I am, you have an unfair advantage over me. And when that happens in sequence, you do that again and again and again, and eventually I will start breaking the rules too. And then once we start all breaking the rules, then the rules break down, and then we end up in an anarchist society, and it's worse for everybody. So, you know, this is the small crimes lead to big crimes, right? The you got away with it once, you'll do more, whole escalation thing. And, you know, I don't claim to have the solution, because I've tried the zero tolerance approach. You know, I tried this on the internet. I set up I had a site, and I just said, look, we're going to look at every packet. And if you send us a packet that's not an authorized packet, or that's, you know, we can tell is a bad packet, we're going to hunt you down. And I did that. And I did that, and then I got some people unhappy at me. So that group of people, they were not anonymous. This was before anonymous. That group of people, including some of the crypto people, decided to come after me. So they did a distributed denial of service against my servers in the late 1990s, and I caught them. Every one of them that thought they couldn't get caught, I caught them by contacting all the systems administrators on all the intervening systems that they went through, asking them to look at their logs, tracked it back. Okay, so now I know who it is that's initiating these things. And most of them just stopped. One of them was going to continue. So I did what you're supposed to do. I called law enforcement. Law enforcement said, there's really nothing we can do about it right now. But we'll call them up and talk to them. Okay, great. That's going to help me over this. You know, so then I contacted the ISP, the internet service provider, for this person, and talked to the lady who owned it. Now, the lady who owned it said, well, you know, technically, I really don't think I can, you know, cut them off. I mean, you know, there's issues of liability and contract and so forth, but I'll see what I can do and I'll get back to you. So the attack stopped, and I wanted to know what happened. So she got back to me, and here's what she described. She described, well, it was Friday. So what I did was I called him up and I said, you really shouldn't do this. Now, I'm planning to go on a long holiday weekend, and I noticed the wire connecting your internet connection is hanging out of the back of the rack, and I'm afraid I might trip over it on my way out the door for the weekend. Apparently, that was sufficient to cause him to cease and desist, and she didn't have to trip over the wire on her way out to the weekend, and that attack ended. Subsequently, law enforcement went and visited the individual and expressed their desire to not have to be pestered by me over him, and expressed to him that he really shouldn't do this and that there are technically laws that, you know, they'd rather not have to enforce on him. So he didn't do that anymore. So the zero tolerance approach worked, except the lesson I learned was, you know, what they were actually doing in the first place wasn't as much of a bother as all the process to get back at it. Now, I wrote an article on it about distributed coordinated attacks, which I think was one of the first articles on distributed denial of services through distributed coordinated attacks, which I thought was fairly interesting. So I got
the benefit of an article about it, and we learned something that was likely to come up soon and in larger volume in the future and how to deal with it. And of course, it did come up larger and soon and in larger volume, and we already had a guideline on how to get from here to there. But I don't think that the zero tolerance approach is likely to be something that people want to engage in unless they want to get zero tolerance coming back at them.
Well, but I'll answer the question you asked, you know, the lead of that story. And the answer is this, right? Radio shows, conversations, freedom of speech, right? You know, what we're talking about the last segment, you know, engaging, you know, my recommendation to people, to my kids and, you know, to anybody else is care about something once in your life, right? Go to city hall meetings, you know, carry a sign in a protest, you know, for or against something. Right. You know, have your voice. And that's how we mitigate everything. Right.
Civil discourse, not uncivil discourse, not throwing rocks at things, not screaming in people's ears. Civil discourse.
I mean, like, be clear, you know, violence. I'm not talking about violence, you know, physical stuff. But, you know, if you want to get worked up and yell and shout, you know, I don't know. People do these sort of things. My point is.
Don't go swatting people. Right.
Well. Yeah, lots of stupid things not to do. However, my point is, you know, that the way you deal with all of these things is by discourse, right? Because a lot of the, you know, when a demographic, a group, a country, a community, you know, is veering towards an uncomfortable, you know, barrier, you know, getting more and more pick something, you know, that people just generally don't like, there's a shared desire for that not to be the case. And the conversations we have as individuals and in forums like this, where, you know, people can listen and feel like, you know, be part of a larger conversation, are how we all work through them together and come up with the new rules, policies, technologies, whatever, right? So this is, you know, a lot of my faith is literally just in this, right? Because you and I are recording this radio show. It's being, you know, broadcast, you know, out of Monterey in the real world. You know, we're not paid by a government, and we're not influenced by a state power.
Not just to Monterey. It goes generally to the Bay Area of San Francisco. It reaches as far as San Francisco into some of the inland valleys and along the California Central Coast. It certainly gets to San Jose as well. So if you're going to say that, you know, and of course it's available over the internet. As soon as the show airs, it's available over the internet at thecybershow.co. So we don't want to fail to properly advertise ourselves by merely saying it comes out of Monterey.
Right. And, you know, they take all the things I rant about. You know, there's a capitalist, you know, this is part of what Fred and I do for a living, whether it pays us directly or not. You know, these are the things we do. It's part of this grand conversation we all have, you know, its own little part, you know, but that's a good thing. There is no big part. Let's all move to North Korea. There's only one conversation, you know, and you're all listening to it. And one person is saying it. You know, rather than that, let's engage in this. You know, let's all talk to each other, think through these things. You know, sometimes one of us has a good idea and the rest of us can figure out how to make it work. And we solve something we were all doing.
But usually when I have that good idea, nobody listens to me.
Oh, you'd be surprised. You know.
Yes, I would. I'm easy to tune out, but don't. Stay on this channel because I won't be here that long.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand. Okay, we're back with Rand, and now we're going to talk about SMISC and this sounds like a Bond movie. SMISC. It's like Smash or whatever. So tell everybody what SMISC is. What does it stand for?
It stands for Social Media and Strategic Communication.
Okay. And you've been working, obviously, on the disinformation and counter-disinformation space for a long time.
Yeah.
And so tell everybody what SMISC was about and how that worked.
Well, it was really about, trying to understand basic mechanisms of how information is disseminated and how, you know, diffusion, how information is diffused in social media spaces. So it was basic ideas about that. It was how do you detect, you know, people doing bad things in these spaces. I mean, it was.
Bad things. Let's talk about what's a bad thing, right? So there's artificial amplification.
Yeah.
That's presumably a bad thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, and then there's lies, you know, just disinformation campaigns.
right?
Yeah.
And then there's child exploitation.
Yeah.
And criminal activities.
Yeah.
Right? Theft and all that stuff. Yeah. There's surveillance, right? There's all sorts of ways that people can take the information and fuse it together and solve the puzzle problem.
Yeah.
So that they can use that information to then exploit you. And then they can use social media to exploit you. And then they can use the social media influence campaigns to disrupt, for example, what's happening inside a company, to create disgruntled employees, to turn individuals, groups of individuals, get clicks together and turn them, advertising, obviously, and sales. And then there's the sort of national level thing where they can change the national sentiment. In, you know, influence elections and possibly on a global basis, change the nature of society. So which of these problems did you solve and how can we fix it?
Well, it, you know, I don't know if we solved any of those problems, but we certainly came up with a lot of techniques to use to manage them or to deal with them. The problem is that you're not allowed to look at, you know, I don't know how can I describe this. You can't look at real data so much to actually look at real problems. You can't, you know, you're not allowed to look at data that involves U.S. people, U.S. persons. You're not allowed. There's all kinds of restrictions on what you can do, and the restrictions are so onerous that you can't really apply the techniques to solving any actual problems because you're not allowed to be doing that.
When you say you're not allowed, you mean the government's not allowed?
I mean the government, specifically privately you can do anything you want with the data. There's no problems at all. But if you're in the government, there are so many restrictions on you that you can't really do much of any use.
So one of the problems here is that the government cannot provide for the common defense.
Yes, I think that the restrictions are so onerous that the government, in fact, cannot provide proper defense of the citizens.
And our
opposition are well aware of that, because our opposition can monitor the social media, public social media data. They can participate. They can do anything they want, which the U.S. government cannot do.
So let's just talk about that space. I've been studying this for quite a long time, not since the time when you started your dissertation. Although, you know, as before that in my life, I learned how to break into systems and how to defend them and so forth, physically, and then exploiting people. So all of us have this in us, right?
Yeah.
That is, you know, we all influence each other. That's the way we survive. That's the way our societies work.
Yeah.
So there's these philosophical questions of where you draw the line. That is, where a government or an individual or an organization draws the line. And I think for the U.S. government, the line is drawn at don't do anything. And for the people, anybody living here, you can just do about anything you want as long as it's not actually a crime. Is that right?
Pretty much.
So it's about money and power and influence, right? More money gives you more capability to apply more computational power to, you know, find things and exploit them and try and influence people and so forth, right?
Yeah.
So now you have these huge social media companies.
Yeah.
All right. So let's just talk, and I'm going to stay away from politics, but Elon Musk buys Twitter.
Yeah.
Right. And so now Twitter, with its enormous ability to look at stuff, see everything that's been communicated over many years, plus the ability to do psychometric analysis, which has improved dramatically over the years.
Plus, and don't forget the ability to prevent anybody else from looking at all the data.
Right, getting that exclusive. Now, in Twitter, there was a feed you could get the fire hose from Twitter for a long time, maybe not anymore. And then, of course, they can selectively give you or not give you certain data.
Yeah.
so that they just have their advantage. The advertising data was never available, what people pay to advertise to whom and so forth, how their influence campaigns are working. With this vast array of information, you have the ability with the psychometrics to really exploit people horrifically. And I'll take you to LinkedIn. LinkedIn today has algorithms so that whatever people post on LinkedIn, if you pay them a fee, you can have it look at the historical information from the individuals, do psychometric analysis, and they'll actually advise you on what techniques and what sequence to use to sell things to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and there's all sorts of metrics for that. So, and then right now there's a program that's, I guess, just recently started from IARPA, Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency, on trying to use, we'll call it cognitive defenses against computer attacks, where you detect somehow the cognitive processes that are going on in the minds of the attackers or in their methodologies, and try to use deception to defend against them.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that this area of cognitive defense is a vast area that's going to be very large scale for a very long time. It has been around forever, but it hasn't been automated in computers. We haven't had the tools and the mechanisms and the content to do this before. And of course, you get these large language models that are taking vast amounts of information, and all of those sorts of models and the content behind them is presumably exploitable for social influence as well. So what are we looking at here?
Well, we're looking at the catastrophe, because the U.S. government, and most Western governments, for that matter, are so restricted in what they can do that they'll never be able to deal with this kind of thing. I mean, cognitive warfare is what people are calling cognitive warfare. I mean, it's I don't really see in the U.S. or in NATO or in Europe in general how they would ever be able to develop these techniques given the kind of restrictions that they live under.
Well, so
whereas our competitors have no such restrictions. And yeah,
you call them competitors. You call them competitors like it's a business deal.
Yeah, well.
But it's not, right? I mean, we're talking about the social media influence campaigns of, and we'll use the bizarre term radical Islamic terrorists for the events that we have in the news these days. But, you know, this is a long-term play for a bunch of religious participants, for Russia. Obviously, they've been taking, you know, a long-term approach to influence operations. China has been doing this. So is, you know, what is this, the end of Western civilization as we know it? Or, you know, and we feel fine?
Unless something gives. Something's got to give. It can't continue the way it has been.
Or else what?
Well, or else it will be the end of this Western civilization, because, I mean, these guys will ultimately succeed in whatever it is they're trying to do.
So how close are we to a turning point right now?
Well, I don't know what you mean by turning point. I mean, I don't think we're close to any point of no return, if that's what you mean.
Okay, that'd be a good thing to know.
Yeah, so, but
how,
then...
How far are we?
Well, how far? I don't know how to measure how far, but all I know is that that there have to be a lot of really fundamental changes in the approach to the whole subject. Well, or these guys, like I say, they'll succeed in whatever it is they're trying to do. They'll all succeed. Right.
Well, so you don't have to be hopeful on the program, but can you give us some ideas of what might work?
Well, the problem is that the kinds of techniques, the kinds of things that will work and that you have to do, they're not, in the West, they're not willing to do these kind of things. It's considered bad form. And they're not going to do it.
You mean the nation states?
Yes. Privately, people do all kinds of things. I mean, we have, you know, the influence for hire business as a mercenary business is huge.
Oh, tell me about that business, because I didn't know what the business model was, but I'm looking for a job, so what the heck?
Oh, well, they'll work for anybody. I mean, for example, you know, you hear about the $100,000 that the Russians spent on Facebook ads, you know, in the last election before and so on. But you hardly hear anything about the $50 million they spent between, say, 2008 and 2015, thereabouts. $50 million they spent on U.S. public relations firms. You don't hear too much about that. But that's, I think, a lot more interesting than the lousy $100,000 they spent on Facebook. And if you look at these companies who do that, you know, some of these, like some of the well-known companies, and these are big companies, some of them, if you look at their customer list, you'll see, like, you know, the worst, horrendous dictators in countries from all over the world are their customers. They're working for anybody. If you pay them, they do the job. So it's a purely mercenary thing. You have the same thing. There are people who specialize in political operations. So they'll help you. They'll run domestic campaigns for you. I mean, and they do all kinds of work. They do all kinds of tricks. I mean, it's, yeah. And it's a big business.
So you know a lot about this, right? You know a great deal about this. And then there's a couple of important things to note about that. One of them is you've been posting on LinkedIn a series of slides talking about the disinformation techniques and the cognitive influence techniques.
Yeah.
Do you have one place where there's a collection where people can read about and understand that? Or do you teach a course in that? Or how can people get that kind of information?
Well, I actually had a course that I taught that I was going to teach. But I was going to teach it here, but it never happened. And I haven't been able to get anybody in the U.S. interested in the course. I taught it once overseas, or twice overseas, but I couldn't get anybody here interested. So instead, I'm posting the slides. These slides are from this course. The slides are all from the course. There's about 400 of them. And it's really divided into 14 lectures. And I just post one a day. It's like a... Somebody said it like a calendar. Every day you have a new page with a new idea.
I'll get your course online through iZen, which is a company that we work with that I have equity in. And I also have a book called Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them. Uh-huh. And that's freely available online. So we try to push that out. We have a short course on deception and counter-deception. So so we'd be happy to help you get that into the market. Not that you'll get many sales for it, but at least it'll be somewhere that's accessible. But besides that, you're just posting one at a time. You have the material to develop a course for it. So if you can develop a course, that'd be a great thing. And I think we could get some of our audience, usually get at least one or two people to sign up, uh-huh. which is not enough to make any money, but it's you can help. Okay, so there were so many nice little chunks of information in that discussion that I don't even hardly know where to start.
I'll start with this. At the end of the day, this is, the practical philosophical conflict between open and close. We generally, share a philosophy, in nationally and, in our global sphere, that transparency and openness is just better. I mean, it can be morally better, ethically better, but it's also more efficient, more effective, more competitive. And in disinformation campaigns and all of this stuff, as Rand's saying, given open systems and open societies, it's really hard to defend against that. So my general, answer is that, let's attack, right? Let's attack with more transparency. As you know, I have my thoughts about some technical things that geeks can do to make it a little slightly easier for the average person to know whether or not, something is transparent or, likely to be real or not. I'm not talking about fact checking, but I think there's some things you can do there. But I think this is about leaning in. This is a great global conflict because, since the French Revolution, pick a spot, but, we've been debating globally, do we need dictators and kings? Because there's no way to figure out, who's telling the truth or not. Or is it somehow possible that we can have open systems and democracy and debate and free speech and more often figure out what's real than if we just listen to whoever shouts at us?
So what I'm getting from you here, Chris, is that you're just thinking that there doesn't seem to be an apparent way that the open systems can effectively cope with this.
No, I think quite the opposite. I think the way to cope with it is not try to be closed systems. Say, let's write even more open, right? Like extortion, me, right? I have such a chip on my shoulder. Anybody that tries to extort me with anything, it's like, I will immediately publish. I don't know, even if it's not true. We think you did this. It's like, okay, I did this. Take the power away from your enemy, right?
So time to transparency is one of your, it's the key, right? So what you want is for it to be totally transparent who did what, but the people that do this, they're fighting the other side of this. They're trying to conceal who they are and what they're doing.
Right. So just like we have done with America, we're a land of refugees because a lot of oppressive states over the centuries have driven people out and they've come here. And what we've done with them is, rule the world. and because it's just more efficient, effective, everything else. You know, open systems, open, you know, freedom, democracy, you know, apple pie, you know, call it what you want.
Well, but they've now taken on the tactic of infiltration. That is to say, they're going to take advantage of that free movement into our society to move in.
Not new. Sorry. You know, when I was a kid in the 70s, I developed this, you know, little joke, I would say, you know, sort of picking on the Archie Bunker older folks and saying, oh, it's a communist plot to undermine the youth of our country. As I got older, I realized, of course, the USSR, of course, was running a communist plot to undermine the youth of our country. Not because, you know, and you understand how these things work. In an influence campaign, it's not because, you know, Russia agrees with liberal Berkeley grads. They're just trying to cause trouble, right? And they did it very successfully, right? You know, you look for weaknesses in your opponent, and you try to exacerbate, you know, conflicts, internal stress, and everything else. So this is not new. And while I I'm always happy to hold to account when you can show that people are just lying, you know, have at it. But structurally, this is open versus closed. And our answer should be in the open space, where it just becomes more attractive on average for people of all sorts in various ways to interact with the open systems, so that's how we win, as opposed to trying to, you know, point by point, undo disinformation, like playing into our enemy's strengths.
So that's a fascinating thing you're saying, but I'm not sure I buy into it, because, you know, they have a lot of resources, more resources they're applying to it than the even the openness resource being applied, right? So if you just say, we're going to be open, we're going to reveal everything that's, you know, the underlying truth of it, they're trying to hide, and we can't really force them not to.
Well, and again, you know some of my thoughts on this. I think there are some technical things we can do, you know, that would make it, again, we're not talking about, you know, proving it, disproving it, all every single thing. But you use the term, you know, time to transparency. You know, if we can reduce time to transparency so the average American, when they're looking at some piece of information, whatever it is, you know, work, social media, whatever, can have a slightly stronger feeling that it's safe, it's right. Right. You know, and that they can act on it.
And, okay, and when you say we can do that, the social media sites are, you know, literally the people that are not doing that. And they know they're not doing it. They're not doing it because that makes the money.
Well, and they're not doing it because it's also very, 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 very complicated. Right. Let's be clear. It's nice. It's fun to pick on big companies. But you and I know some of the people at these big companies who have taken on that responsibility. I wouldn't do it on a bet. Right. You know, it's technical. These are emergent areas. The technology is not always there. You know, they don't, you know, their customers, the companies haven't been around for a million years. They can barely, you know, understand themselves. And now we're going to get them to solve this. No, I think it's a broader and smaller thing than that. I think, again,
but hang on, it's not that they're trying to solve it and not able to do so. That's also true for some of them. But a lot of the big ones are just not trying to solve. I mean, they're intentionally not solving it, right? They'll throw something at it for publicity, but they cut down the size of the workforce. They, you know, they enable things that they weren't disabling 2 years ago. You know, they're going with the political winds and so forth.
Yeah. Again, you know, there's a small ball, big ball. I don't know. I've been trying to find an analogy for this. You know, there's, you know, the day-to-day operations of a company, Facebook, for example, you know, they'll do what they do. And they say they hire a CISO who really cares about this. And that person puts together a plan over the next 6 quarters to do various things. It takes 90 days to do anything whatsoever. Then you have a large bureaucracy to make decisions to do things. To your point, the financial pressures justifying spending these resources to do these things in ways that may just flagrantly violate, you know, the revenue streams that your shareholders are responsible for. My point is, I don't see a lot of nefarious intent. I don't think there was executives at Facebook sitting around saying, oh, this disinformation makes us a lot of money. How do we encourage it? There's not a lot of reason for them to do otherwise, because if you make more money, you keep your job.
Well, not right? Speaking particularly about Facebook, but there are certainly instances we've seen where there's evidence presented of internal messaging and so forth that says, in fact, they're doing that intentionally. It's not because they want disinformation, although I guess some of them might. It's really because they want money.
Right? Well, again, obviously it's because they want money. Let's look at the drivers, look at the motivations. Why are things happening the way they are? You know, these are commercial companies. And again, you can be a wonderful individual with the authority and do something that's wonderfully ethical that costs shareholder money and lose your job and be replaced by somebody else, right? You know, this is the Mr. Smith goes to Washington paradox, right? How do you get the authority and then not lose that authority, you know, to do good things? And again, my point here is that, you know, while keeping pressure on these individuals and individual organizations is lovely, I think that, you know, we both at a technical level need to keep focusing on how to, you know, enable time to transparency in all ways. And the national level, you know, as a country and as large groups in the country, you know, we should, again, lean into the openness and make that a more attractive place, you know, create evolutionary forces as opposed to trying to, you know, wipe out our enemy on the battlefield.
All right. So it's interesting, the notion of creating these evolutionary forces, because it's not obvious how to do that or what to do. But I do want to get to the stuff Rand specifically talked about, which was, well, one of them is that as a nation state, because of the legal structures, we refuse to provide for the common defense.
Yeah.
Well, okay. If it's not a common defense, now we're talking about all the individuals who, you know, spread across the spectrum are being influenced to take different positions, and a smaller number of people with lots of power and influence and money, then, you know, pushing their positions with a lot of amplification.
Well, you know, I don't know that, you know, look, you know, Rand, you know, like all of our friends and peers and guests and so forth, is, you know, has an enormous amount of experience and authority in what they're saying. However, I don't think that's literally true, right? I think, you know, from his perspective, and I know a lot of our friends feel the same sort of way, you know, and I feel like, you know, effectively we have not provided for the common defense for a lot of reasons. And, you know, and again, you know, because we have a open government, you know, a closed, a corrupt government can fight this war all day long because nobody cares. There's no accountability. Once you put accountability in, it gets really hard, to figure out exactly what at a national level you can do without looking like you're one party taking sides against another and, you know, causing more internal conflict than you solve.
Yeah, no, the corrupt government won't do it. They'll do the opposite.
Right. Corrupt government just does the, Russia, you know, Russia is a dictatorship. And, you know, there's no internal controls. There's no safety controls. You know, as one of my favorite examples of stuff is, you're an American citizen and your information is touched by an NSA analyst. There's seven things that analyst has to do to justify and document why they touched your data. If you're a Russian citizen and some Russian, you know, security analyst looks at your data, there's nothing they need to do because there's no accountability. So, yeah, you can run disinformation campaigns and everything else at the national level and it just works. We can't do that. And we shouldn't try, right? What we should do is find a way to counter that. And again, my, you know, American bones tell me the way to do that is to create a marketplace that is more attractive than that one.
All right. When you say that, it's easy to say, but apparently not so easy to do. But let's go on to some of the other terms he used, right? He talked about cognitive warfare.
Yeah.
And something's got to give.
Yep.
Okay. Well, so what's giving right now, you know, is, you know, the unified view of the world of the United States or the population of the United States. We're becoming a very fragmented society. And, you know, it's fragmenting along multiple fracture lines.
I think that's true, right? You know, and I know that I, you know, feel that I'm quite often trying to talk people out of the trees. You know, let's not freak out. You know, let's put things in perspective, deal with it appropriately. But there's real problems, right? And that's one of ours now. And it's partly, you know, not due to you know, nefarious purposes or actors. It's just because it's one of the natures of the internet. Michael Burke, you know, back at Borderware, C-Chain, one of the two bosses I had, you know, when I got into the whole security and firewall market, you know, we debated this and was debating it to this day, right? You know, he's saying that he was right, and I'm saying he was right so far, because he was saying that the internet's going to balkanize and we're going to end up with all these little bubbles and everybody's got their own bubble. And that's true. That's where we are, right? It's a lovely thing that if you're, you know, an unusual person in your small community, you can find a lot of people like you globally and share a lot of experiences, and it's a good and wonderful thing. However, you can also stay inside that bubble and forget that the rest of the world exists. And now we add, you know, nefarious actors to that who are intentionally leveraging all that, and we find ourselves here.
Okay. It sounds like that hopeful thing is going away, but that's okay. Then
what I'm saying is it's not surprising. So if it's not surprising, we just need to figure it out.
If you can do it in time, but your view is that in the long term, that is the very, very, very long term, it'll work itself out.
Well, yeah, you know, maybe not. You know, again, this is maybe humans cannot deal with open systems. Maybe the best, you know, social structures, though you and I may not like them, are dictatorships, right? I don't think the human species has yet demonstrated this fully out. And I don't expect this to for, you know, quite a few generations. But, you know, I would like to think that open systems work better. You know, experience in my life, the success of the U.S. versus the USSR, for example, you know, supports that. The internet, you know, an open system, that supports that. But, you know, this is another real conflict. We have to decide, you know, as a species, what do we want?
Well, so now another thing that I was very impressed with is the mercs for hire, right?
Right.
So, you know, 50 million.
50 billion. That's billion.
On PR firms over 7 years, right? That, sure. Boy, does that
happen. That's probably the tip of the iceberg.
Of course it is. That's just so lucky. The PR firms have been figuring out a lot about the Palestinian conflict. They've done a tremendous job on the part of the Palestinians. They've got these sort of trademark phrases that they use. In fact, one of the interesting, you know, twists that I've been trying to do very recently, I'm just starting to play with this one, is countering them with the free Iran. So they're saying free Palestine. I'm going to say free Iran. Iran has been taken over by the radical Islamists, free Iran. There's actually a pretty substantial freedom movement within Iran that we can support and start to use the same memes. So, you know, what they've done is the 1984 twisting of words, right? So they use the words, you know, genocide and occupation and all these things in almost the opposite of the truth, right? Ethnic cleansing, just as far opposite of the truth as you can get. And so I think, you know, one of the counters is to use the same phrase against them that they use against you. And
sure.
I realize that's the two-year-old approach to say, you know, you hit me. No, you hit me. No, you know, but it does disrupt that meme, right?
Well, you know, kung fu, right? You know, you know, hacking, you know, folks out there, look, if you want to be a hacker, do things. What hackers do is they try all sorts of things. So by the time a hacker, me, is serious about actually doing something, it's because I've done a bunch of the things already, right? You know, like you're saying, Fred, you know, engage in arguments. Try that. Try different things. I don't know. But you'll get a feel for what works and what doesn't. And maybe that can help, you know, come up with, you know, the big solutions and the big answers. Because, there's look, right, you know, these, you know, as I said before, you know, I led in leadership of a presidential rapid response, you know, program. It was all volunteers. And we all did this, you know, for, you know, nearly a year. I know how that works, you know, and I love debate, right? And if you, you know, you really want to forget about the structure of how we're talking, the actual ideas themselves, let's debate everything. I don't know the answers. Debate is a wonderful thing. So, you know, response and counter and, you know, these are all very, very real and good things. Like the disarm structure that Pablo Brouwer and S.J. Turpin Associates have put together is a good way of looking at, you know, influence campaigns and deciding which you do. You know, not everybody, you know, but Fred, you and I are, you know, old school cyber geeks who work with standards and governments and corporations. Maybe we can influence things on some technical levels in a professional level. But personally, yeah, you know, doing the same thing everybody else does. You know, try to debate with your crazy aunt and uncle at Thanksgiving. Maybe they're right.
Which is an interesting thing, you know, the maybe they're right part, because obviously, you know, Western civilization has been under its own influence campaign, certainly since we were born, with the, you know, information about the white founders and ignoring, you know, the history of African Americans and their contribution. And, and so on and so forth, and not just the African Americans, and not just the, you know, so forth. I'm telling
you, Chinese laborers and everything else. Yeah, but
everything else, right? So then, you know, if you're going to go down this line, there's another thing that has come to my attention lately, which is, generally speaking, the belief that the fever might be breaking.
Right.
And I have the notion that, you know, lies only go so far. Eventually, right, facts are really stubborn things, and people start to notice the facts.
Right.
Well, exactly. So I have a sneaking suspicion that, I mean, an example, you know, the economy in the U.S. has added, I think it's 100,000, 300,000, a lot of jobs month after month after month. Inflation has, you know, gotten sort of under control. It's not accelerating. It's now decelerating. And you know, the timing of this is always suspicious coming before elections. But now you hear, you know, and I want to stay out of politics and back into the fact space. My point is that the facts are at odds with the influence operations.
Right.
And it's harder for facts about something happening, or, you know, across the world in Gaza or something like that, than it is for facts that have to do with, you know, where you're sitting. You know, are you making more money than you were making last year? Do you have a job when you didn't have a job last year? It's hard to fight against those facts, right? Because you can only do that so long before you realize you have a job and you are eating, right?
Yeah, reality creeps back in, right? You know, that's, this is why, you know, most people, you know, tend to be really honest, you know, because, and so most people have said this, you know, to each other and everybody else, and it's just, lying is a lot of work, right? You got to maintain it. Now, once you lie about anything, you got to remember who you lied to, what you lied to, why you lied to, who, you know, what was the situation, and it's just a lot of baggage, right? You know, so running, you know, and we've seen this in totality, well, North Korea, right, you know, or, you know, Big East Germany, or, you know, Soviet Russia. Yeah, you know, they had huge numbers of people just dedicated to keeping all the lies straight. So it's not really efficient, right? It's not competitive in the long term, is my point.
Well, but that's no longer called for. Apparently now you don't have to keep your lies straight. You can just say a different thing every moment. And if your personality is good, people buy into it.
Oh, yeah, you showed a little hope there for a second. You said you think it's running its course, right? Because, you know, nobody likes being lied to, right, and being, you know, embarrassed and so forth. And, you know, I've got a friend who's a truck driver, right? You know, very conservative guy. And we're talking about this. And he's saying to the point now that he stops at truck stuff, nobody's talking to each other because they now each have so many different, you know, conspiracy theories that they're arguing about, you know, the details of which ones are true, right? And it just gets, you know, runs its course, to your point, you know, and it sort of gets boring and tiring and too much bloody work. And,
right, and what that speaks to then is the approach of all right, as long as they're going to have conspiracy theories, we're just going to add as many as we can. So we're just going to diffuse the whole conspiracy theory so that those clicks become smaller and smaller and people disagree more and more about those things, and finally they abandon them.
Yeah, they evaporate. You're the last two guys to walk away from the temporary clubhouse.
Yeah, so I'm increasingly thinking that that's what's going to destroy it, that eventually lies just cannot hold up. And, I mean, they do it for a while, and they can be very damaging.
And they can do it long enough. You can win with lies. You know, you can win the battle, win the war, even though that's, you know, not the best approach, because sometimes, you know, the good guys don't have the time to fight.
Well, you say the good guys are the ones who tell the truth, but
yeah,
you know, that's a matter of opinion.
They're the ones on your side, whoever they are, whatever side that is.
There you go. And I'm on the side of truth, justice, and the American way, but I am not, unfortunately, Superman, so I can't enforce it. Actually, it's fortunate that I'm not Superman, because my enforcement would probably screw up big time.
Superman would say, so now I think he may be.
Well, of course, Superman would never admit to being Superman, but I'm not. Just so, to be clear, I'm not Superman and I'm not Batman. So sorry for anybody that thought I was. Nope, that's not it.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show,
Pete hacks high school, and the hackers hack Pete. Rand reaches the end of the road, so which way will he turn? A pitch is sliding your way, but will it throw a curve? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A strain beaten man, and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.